Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Not a Parasha Share this week. For the next 2 weeks, maybe even, as I think about it, next 3 weeks, because Purim actually falls later in the week, for the next few weeks, we won't be actually having a Parasha Share. And part of that has to do with the fact that obviously it's going to be Purim, where we will be reading Megillat Esther, and second, because this week is Pekudei, next week is Vayikra, and the week after that is Tzav. And while there are, you know, there is plenty of content we could talk about, it is perhaps a much nicer and more enjoyable Torah learning experience to focus a bit on Megillat Esther. So last year, I actually gave, I believe it was in the end, a three-part series in the run-up to Purim, exploring some of the broader themes, some specific broader themes of Megillat Esther. If you didn't hear those, you would like to hear them again. They're available on YU Torah from last year. But what I want to do today is not so much present a grand overarching theory, a grand narrative. It's not so much to highlight a broad theme of Megillat Esther, even though we will start to touch on one of the themes of Esther. But what I actually want to do is I want to begin by, and in a second I'll share my screen, and it's just Megillat Esther. And what I want to kind of go through, we're not going to go through it line by line because I could not do that to myself, let alone to anyone else. But I do want to kind of highlight some really interesting ideas that emerge just by paying some attention to the actual verses, because Megillat Esther, probably more than any other biblical book, is the most intentionally crafted. It's the most carefully created, carefully written. Every single word packs a punch. And Megillat Esther, we could spend an entire year learning Megillat Esther every once a week, you know, every single week. And every single week we could say something novel, something that's substantial and real, and we would still barely scratch the surface of things we could say about Esther. So there's a lot to say about Esther, and every single year I feel like I think this, and I've started to say this every year. It's a real shame that we don't start thinking about learning Megillat Esther until the weeks in the run-up to Purim. And then the second Purim is over, it's like, well, A, now we have to start reading our Haggadot and preparing for Pesach. And by the time Pesach's over, we don't really think about learning Megillat Esther, because as with all the Megillot, we have this problematic mentality, but it's really hard to shake, that it's not appropriate almost to learn the Megillot of Tanakh outside of the schedule of the Chagim. Like Megillat Rut is another one, that it's just like, we really should devote. I have like, it's like an inch plus thick book on Megillat Rut. And every year, a week before Shavuot, I read like the same opening chapter to the book. And I'm like, wow, this is amazing. I should continue to read this after Shavuot. And the minute Shavuot ends, I'm like, eh, no. And it's a huge problem. And all the more so for Esther, where there is so much. So at this point, I'm going to share my screen. And it's just Megillat Esther. And so for people who are listening to this recording, there is no source sheet being shared, because as long as you have a copy of Megillat Esther in front of you, you should be able to follow along. And I realize I have a lot of different tabs open. They're not actually for the share. I just finished writing my drasha for this Shabbos, so all of these tabs had some relevance to that. But our Megillah begins famously, Vayhi bimei Achashverosh. I will actually, if I can, I will make this slightly bigger. I'll zoom in. Now everyone's kind of blinded by the sheer size of the text, but there you go. Vayhi bimei Achashverosh. It was in the days of Achashverosh. And the Megillah tells us who Achashverosh, Hamolech mehodu viad Kush. He reigned, you know, from Hodu and Kush, whatever exactly we would translate those as. Sheva ve'esrim umeya medina, 127 kingdoms, provinces. There is an important point that is somewhat as an aside to everything else we're going to be talking about, though in some ways it's still significant. The Megillah is locating itself, and I think I spoke about this last year when I did the three-part series also. The Megillah is situating its events to be taking place during the peak of the Persian Empire. So the Persian Empire, and again, I don't want to rehash those things that I spoke about last year, but the Persian Empire was a tremendously significant, successful, powerful empire that in many ways created several institutions that to this day society has preserved in some form or another. And so by locating it, it's a very interesting phrase. It was in the times of Ahasuerus. Who Ahasuerus Hamolech Me'od Bekodesh? This is the Ahasuerus. It was during these times. It was during this person. You know, he was the leader during this the peak of the Persian Empire. You know, there are a couple of interesting comments just to make on this number 127. So, without trying to do too much of the how do we align the story of Esther with the historical knowledge we have, because while that can enrich our appreciation of Megillat Esther, there is always an element of unwillingness to playing the historical game because it starts to get very tricky very quickly. But there was never really a time when the Persian Empire controlled 127, you know, kingdoms, literally. And again, the JPS 1985 translation, that's what you're seeing on the left, you know, translates it as provinces instead, because typically we translate it as 127 kingdoms. That's a lot. That is, I don't even know how many in its peak kingdoms the British Empire controlled, but that was, I think, the biggest empire ever, you know, of human history. But 127 provinces, it's still a good chunk of people. It's still a good chunk of land. Again, what exactly Hodu and Kush are in this sense is perhaps unclear. The second thing that's interesting about this 127 number, and this is just a little, it's almost a non-fact. It's the opposite of a usual fun fact. It's a non-fact. Usually, biblical numbers fit certain types. Biblical numbers like to round up. And biblical numbers like to be thematically similar. So, you know, the number 40, 40 days, 40 nights, you know, 40 years. The number 40 recurs, you know, lots of times. The number 10, you know, there are certain numbers that you will find recurring over and over again. And the point Tanakh is always making when it does this is it's trying to connect a thread. It's a literary, you know, there may be an instance at some point in Tanakh where it wasn't actually 40, it was 43. But Tanakh would rather say 40 because A, Tanakh is not trying to be a work of history. And second, it really wants to try and make that theological connection. It wants to hit you over the head with the theological connection of 40. So usually biblical numbers fit to a text. Sheva ve'esrim umeyah, 127, doesn't really do that. If Esther were following the typical biblical mode, it would do 120. 120 is a recurring biblical number. It is actually somewhat peculiar that Megillat Esther gives us a more precise number. Then, barring very specific situations, Tanakh does not like providing very, very, very specific numbers. There is one other occurrence of the number 127 in Tanakh, and that is Vayihu Chaye Sarah. These are the years of Sarah. Sarah lived 127 years. And that is the only other occurrence of the number 127 in Tanakh. And there is a famous, famous midrash. And it seems very clear, and I probably mentioned this before in some other context, because I always like pointing it out, because I'm one of those people who likes pointing these kinds of things out. The original context of the Midrash is very clear that, and I forget who it was, but one of the rabbis was giving a class, and he sees everyone starting to fall asleep. So in order to wake everyone up, he says something absolutely ridiculous in order to jar them back to focus. And he says, you know, the 127 Medinot provinces that Ahasuerus controlled corresponds to the 127 years of Sarah's life. And it's, again, pretty clear from the context of this Midrash that it's supposed to be an absolutely crazy statement purely to wake people up. You do see Divrei Torah that kind of roll with this Midrash as pointing out a genuine connection between the two it's really hard to do so. The most convincing I have ever come across, and I say most convincing with a tremendous, you know, not just a grain of salt, but with, you know, silos worth of salt, is that the entire setup of Perek Aleph is really getting towards Esther, and therefore Vashti will die. Like, the whole point of Perek Aleph, the reason we have it there is to explain why is Ahasuerus looking for a wife. So, we have to kill off Vashti in Perek Aleph. We have to get rid of her. She has to, you know, exit stage right. And in order to do that, and that's the purpose of Perek Aleph. And so the 127s both correspond to moments in which a biblical woman dies that then leads to these major, you know, future changes amongst the Jewish people. When Sarah dies, that is when, you know, we get the trigger for Yitzhak and Yitzhak's search for a wife and the continuation of the Jewish people. When Vashti dies, Esther steps onto the scene. Again, it's not the world's most convincing thing that I personally have ever come across, but that is maybe the literary connection the Megillah is possibly going for. There is something very interesting, though, to start to look at a slightly broader trend that comes up, which is really, really cool. Yonatan Grossman, one of my favorite readers of Tanakh, points this out. We should just look at the number of times the Megillah references Ahasuerus's malchut, his kingship, his rulership, the fact that he is in charge. It was in the days of Ahasuerus. Who Ahasuerus hamol? Can people see my? I know no one has their screen on. So can someone confirm if I wave my cursor? Can you see that or not? Someone unmute yourself and tell me if you see my cursor. If you don't see my cursor, then you don't see it. And if you,
I do, see it.
Okay, so you can see my cursor. Okay, because I want to know, with Safari, when you want to highlight something, if you click on something to highlight it, it does what we just saw. It highlights the wrong place. It brings up the panel. So it's a really bad way to highlight. But I want to draw your attention to things by gesticulating wildly with my mouse. So as you can see, my mouse is hovering over Hamolech. And we're looking for, again, the root of rulership, Malchut, Melech, Mem, Lamed, Chaf. Let's see all the times that the Megillah starts by referencing it. So Ahasuerus is Hamolech. Bayamim Haheim, in those days, Kesheret Hamelech Ahasuerus al Kisei Malchuto. King Ahasuerus occupied his royal throne. Bishnat Shlosh L'malka, in the third year of his reign, another instance. Bahar Otaet Oisha Kavod Malchuta, seeing the glory of his kingship, and then Ve'edikatif Eret Gedulata. Okay, that is not the root referencing his malchut, but it is an adjacent idea, his glory. Uvimloat Hayamim Ha'ila Asaha Melech, the king. In the king's garden. And then, V'yein, verse 7, V'yein Malchut, Rav Kiad Hamelech, royal wine was served as befits a king. There was no rule about the wine in verse 8, Kichein Yisan Hamelech, for the king had uttered. And then it ends with Gam Vashti Hamalka, fine queen, Beit Hamalchut, in the royal palace, Asher Lemelech Ahasuerus, in King Ahasuerus. In other words, if we were to translate this nowadays, it would be like, you know, a president, not only in every single sentence, it then being described as a president, but constantly emphasizing their presidential residence, their presidentiality, that might not be a word, their presidential this, their presidential that, the Megillah hits us over the head with. In its opening 9 verses, in its scene-setting, context-setting verses, Ahasuerus is a kingly king. He is very kingly, he is very important, he is very grand, he is very glorious. Every single act that he does is matched by the weight of the throne. There is There is nothing more official, nothing more royal than Ahasuerus. And given the way this set, the entire Megillah was set up, it was in the days of Ahasuerus, who Ahasuerus Hamolech Me'adubat Kush, the king of the mightiest moment of the Persian Empire. We are anticipating, we are expecting the Ahasuerus to whom we are about to properly meet to be a really kingly, royal figure. And obviously, there is the classic question, there is the classic trope. Is Ahasuerus a dastardly, evil king? Is he a bumbling fool? What is he? You know, this is, it's a familiar trope, in part because the Megillah itself is playing off those two themes as being possible ways to read Ahasuerus. But what we see from the first nine verses is Ahasuerus's tremendous, tremendous kingliness. We are expecting, you know, someone, you know, let's think more along the lines of Queen of England, who is someone who is very much perceived as a very royal, proper ruler, more than, you know, some sort of incompetent, foolish person. That is how the first verses set it up. However, then we read, beginning with verse 10, you know, Ahasuerus wants to bring in Vashti, and Vashti refuses. And we read in verse 12. And again, it's interesting because even in verse 12, again, Vatma ein Hamalka Vashti, but Vashti refused. Lavo bidvar Hamelech, to come on command of the king. So again, it's once again underscoring the kingliness of Ahasuerus. Asher biyad hasarisim, his eunuchs, vaiktsav hamelech ma'od, the king. This kingly person was angry. V'chamatava aravo, his fury burned within him. And then, what happens next? Vayomer hamelech, the king turns, l'chachamim yode'ei ha'itim, to the sages learned in procedure. He has his advisory council. Kichein Dvar HaMelech, verse 13 tells us, and I love that JPS puts, you know, the parentheses to let us know that this is an important parenthetical comment. Kichein Dvar HaMelech lifnei kol yode'ei dat v'din, for it was the royal practice. It was appropriate. It was professional for the king to turn towards his advisors for consultation. And then in verse 14, we get the names. These are the people who were roi pnei hamelech. They had access to him. Hayoshvim rishana b'malchut. They are the most important. They are his right hand men. What is bizarre? What is absolutely bizarre about what follows is the fact that he ultimately turns to his royal council for advice on essentially an interpersonal matter. And this is our first glimpse of, this is the first signal by the Megillah that Ahasuerus is not quite the king we think him to be. Until these Vashti verses, we are getting the sense of this very glorious, powerful king. But now, all of a sudden, a different king starts to emerge. The one who can't make a decision. And Ahasuerus' decision-making is a recurring theme of, or his inability to make decisions, to his decisiveness. His indecisiveness is a recurring theme of the Megillah. But, and how he is manipulated by a whole variety of people. You know, manipulation maybe is always bad, but some people, you know, from the vantage point of the story are good people manipulate him. Some people from our vantage point, bad people of the story manipulate him. Haman manipulates him. Esther manipulates him. Ahasuerus is very easily manipulatable. And that we get the first signal of that here. That Ahasuerus is unable, he's angry with his wife, and yet consults the Yode'ei Dat Vadin. He consults the Supreme Court. It, you know, no leader is supposed to turn to his royal advisors. You know, it might be worth consulting them somewhat in case there is a political fallout, a political mishap. But this idea that Ahasuerus is already talking to them in order to find out how to figure out the situation with his wife is our first signal that something is a little bit strange here. And what's even stranger is how this figure, Memuchan, Chazal famously identified Memuchan here as Haman, but Al Pi Pshat, he's someone else. Memuchan proposes this absolutely nonsensical, ridiculous idea to Ahasuerus, and Ahasuerus rolls with it. Verse 60. Vayomer Memuchan lifnei Amelech. Memuchan turns to the king. Vahasarim and the ministers. Lo ala Melech levado avta Vashti hamalka. Vashti is not just committed, you know, an offense against you. Ki al kol hasarim va al kol hamim, against everyone. Asher bechol medinat hamelech Ahasuerus. Everyone has been offended by Vashti's refusal to come in. Why? Ki yetzei tava hamalka al kol hanashim, for the queen's behavior. Will spread to all the women, lahavzot ba'alehen ba'alehen ba'inehen, who will come to have contempt for their husbands. But Amram HaMelech Ahasuerus Amar Laviat Vashti HaMalka Lefnav Lova, because Ahasuerus told Vashti to come. The fact that she said no means now all women are going to no longer have respect for their husbands. As Memuchan continues, verse 18, this very day they've heard it, Uchtai Bizayon Vaketzaf, Uchtai Bizayon Vakotzef, there will be no end of the scorn. This is insane, right? This is our next window into, not only is Ahasuerus turning to people with advice to handle things that maybe he's trying to by himself, but the people giving the advice do not seem to be giving the best advice. The most loud-spoken, the most outspoken member of Ahasuerus' council is clearly it's someone who does not maintain calm in front of a stressful situation. He's a fatalist. He's a, oh my gosh, Vashti's refusing to come. This is it. Open rebellion. That's it. It's done. No longer will any wife respect her husband for what reason whatsoever. His entire mentality is assumption that wives only respect their husbands out of some sort of who knows what. It's crazy. This is madness. And then his solution. Verse 19, Im halamelech tov, if it pleases your majesty, yetzei devar malchut milfanav, let a royal edict be issued by you, vayikotev bedatei parasu madai v'lo ya'avor, written into the laws of Persian media that cannot be ever changed. Let's pass, you know, a constitutional amendment. Ashelo tavo vashti livnei hamelech, that Vashti shall never enter the presence of the king again. Let her be gone with her. Whether exactly, you know, he's proposing her to be killed, but that's pretty much what you do to a queen who's committed essentially an act of treason. This, says Memuchan, verse 20, when people hear of this, now wives will respect their husbands. Because Vashti refused to say no, so now they chopped off her head. Now wives will respect their husbands. This was approved by, this is good, in the eyes of the king, the Hasarim, and his ministers. And the king did as promised. This is crazy. Right? Which point is the madness going to end? And then finally, verse 22, we get the final ratcheting up of the madness. V'yishlach svarim el kol medinat hamelech. Dispatches were sent to every single province. El medina medina kichtaveh ve'am am kilshana. Each and every language, an ambiguous ruling being issued here. Liot kol ish soreb ve'ita. So that every man shall wield authority in his home. Umdaber kilshan amo. And speak the language of his own people. They issued a rule. They issued a law that husbands now wield authority in their own homes. Let's take a step back and analyze. And I'm actually going to make this slightly less zoomed in now because to try and convey a more overarching look. Megillat Esther begins in chapter 1 by introducing us to this very, very powerful and mighty king, situating it in a very significant moment, peak power of the Persian Empire. Everything in these opening 9 verses bespeak the power, the majesty, the glory of the king, and the weight, the significance that rests behind all that he does. And yet then, the Megillah switches, and it introduces us first level to a king who is perhaps a little too reliant on his advisors for help in a situation. That is our first clue that things are not as they seem. Second, the Megillah signals to us that Ahasuerus has not quite appointed as his advisors the greatest minds in the land that we might first think, or at least not the best people in a crisis. Because we get this, and it's funny because as I've been reviewing again to read Megillat Esther for actual Megillah readings, and maybe it's just because again I'm already bringing this interpretation to mind, but like as you read out loud Memuchan's surprisingly long speech, this is something else to note. You don't realize how terse the speaking roles are in Esther. And when Memuchan gets how many verses is this? 5 verses Memuchan gets. That is a lot. You would be surprised at how few verses that some of the most important characters of Esther get as speaking roles. Memuchan gets 5 verses for this rambling, absolutely insane rant against women. It's madness. And I think the rambling of it, the insanity of it, just comes through. Each verse is crazier than the next. And so again, not only is Ahasuerus this very, very powerful king with a tremendous amount of glory, not only is he turning to people for advice, but we get a very, you know, if you want to see how a, you know, leader responds to things, you know, if we translate into the crazy few years we've had in the past, I am relatively sympathetic to giving leaders a certain level of sympathy, trying to handle, be it a worldwide pandemic or, you know, everything going on right now in Ukraine. That is a very, very hard situation. But if you want to see how a leader, you know, they're going to make mistakes. It's uncharted territory, all these various things. But if you watch how a leader responds to a light crisis, how a leader responds to a gentle challenge, that is telling. Vashti doesn't want to come to a party. And I'll talk in a second about why we have reason to believe the classic understanding of what is going on at the party is probably correct. Vashti doesn't want to come. The people advising Ahasuerus propose this absolutely crazy thing, which involves off with her head. And then if that weren't enough, laws are sent out by the king for all wives to respect their husbands in their home. There is a fascinating statement of Chazal here. Let's actually see if I can pull it up by the magic of Sfaria. Yep, here we go. The beauty of Sfaria is we automatically get now appearing on the right-hand panel. Safari is amazing, by the way. Commenting on this verse, the Gemara in Megillah says, Liot kol ish soreh beveito. Every man shall wield authority in his own house. Amar Rava, ilmalei igrot harishonot. If it weren't for these first letters sent, lo nishtaya misonehem shal Yisrael lesarid ufalit. That basically, there would not have been hesitancy by people when the letters went out to exterminate the Jews. Because later in the Megillah, letters are once again going to be sent out to the people that basically on Adar, you know, on the 14th of Adar, we're going to exterminate all the Jews. And there's tremendous confusion in the city. Part of the confusion, obviously, the obvious confusion is the Jewish confusion, but there's a general confusion here. Because these, as I exit the Gemara and Megillah again, imagine you are a citizen of Shushan and your great king has just sent out a royal edict that, you know, people have to be respected in their home. You would start to question the legitimacy of all laws coming through because it looks like the king is slightly unstable. The king is not quite he's not got everything together as much as originally perceived. Argues Rava in the Gemara. Was it Rava or Rav? I forget now. That's bad. I just saw it a second ago along with everyone else. But the instability caused by this, because Rav Soloveitchik points out kind of the obvious point here. You can't make a rule governing, you know, marital dynamics. Every marital relationship is going to have different dynamics. Husband and wives are going to have, spouses are going to have different, you know, interactions with one another. And so in some homes, you know, one will be the more decisive, the more whatever figure, and another won't be. In other, you know, every single family has completely different relationships in this regard. To legislate a way for a husband and wife to have a relationship with one another is the most nonsensical thing in the world. And so this law is so nonsensical that it meant that when future laws would be issued by the king, people were like, wait, what? Are we sure this is a good thing? Especially because what's the very next verse that follows from this? Achashverosh's anger subsides. Zacharet Vashtiva et asher asata v'chengazlan. He starts to regret what he did. And again, imagine you're a member of Shushan. You just witnessed your king, let's just assume she's, you know, beheaded. You just watched your king behead his wife because she was disrespectful. 3 months later, go out the royal proclamations. The king is sad. He wants a wife. He misses Vashti. This is not sowing the seeds of confidence in your leader. And again, these are not unfamiliar themes to Megillat Esther, but what I want to draw your attention to is just how the very structure, wording, framing of Megillat Esther already sets all of this up in the first chapter. It's incredible. It's because, again, every single verse packs a punch in Esther. Everything is doing something to emphasize and to develop the characters and the world in which Esther is taking place. There are so many things to comment on just on these opening verses to Megillat Esther. The other things that I just want to focus on, because again, we're going to have 2 more weeks of discussing Megillat Esther, though we won't focus on Perek Aleph anymore for this one, because one of the other challenges of learning Megillat Esther is there is so much to talk about in the opening parts that we often just completely forget about and abandon learning the later parts of the Megillah. So I'm going to try and devote the next couple of weeks to focusing on the later chapters of Megillat Esther to try and give them the same focus and emphasis that we usually end up only giving to the opening ones. So there's a really interesting line here, and I think I'd pointed this out in the previous series also and not really talked about it anymore. And if I did talk about this at length, I apologize. I mean, it's been a year, so if you still remember, yashakach, I don't even remember if I said it, and if you've forgotten, I will now remind you. So in verse 13, the king consults the Yode'ei Ha'itim, the wise sages. And as we learn, because they are, it was the king's practice to turn kol Yode'ei Dat Vodin, those versed in law and precedent. In other words, this is a kingship governed by laws. This is not a Wild West kingship. This is not, the Megillah is trying to set up a country ruled by whim, a country ruled by mood swings by the king. But as we've just seen, and as the Megillah goes on to say, yes, it is. How often, by the way, does Ahasuerus turn to these Yode'ei? And Persia was famed for being a legal country. And again, reading Megillah Esther as a satire of Persian society, you know, this is one entry window into that whole analysis. But does the king consult the Yode'ei Dat Vadin to about exterminating the Jews? No, he just takes payment from Haman. How often does the king consult the Yode'ei Dat Vadin? We read it slightly earlier in the parak. Where do the laws get written? So first of all, the laws get written to govern, I should add, to govern relationships between husband and wife, a nonsense law. And second, verse 8, Vahashtia Kadat, Ein Onus. The drinking at the party was according to the law. And that law was Ein Onus, no restrictions. You can drink however much or however little you want, because the king had instituted a rule, La'asot Kirtan Ishresh, everyone gets to drink however much they want. The laws are used not to prevent a genocide against the Jewish population within Persia, but the laws are used to institute a rule about the drinking. And that is, again, a chilling indictment of Persian society, that they have no qualms with, you know, Ahasuerus has no qualms with the idea of exterminating a group within its people, but is very, very demanding about there be laws about drinking and there be laws about husbands and wives. Again, the Megillah just sets up so brilliantly what first seems to be a highly functioning, powerful country led by a military leader to actually be the opposite. And this is what births all of those midrashim which tried to explain Ahasuerus usurped the throne, he kind of fell his way into it, Ahasuerus is a fool. All of these various ideas emerge from already the indication within. The one final thing that I want to highlight, just to kind of wrap up this analysis of Perek Aleph, again, you could talk about Perek Aleph for the next 5 hours and not say anything, not repeating ourselves, but we won't do that. This verse number 9, Gam Vashti Hamalka, Asta Mishte Nashim. Vashti gave a banquet for women, which is also in the past. So there's a very strange question here to be asked, which is, why aren't the women invited to this actual party? Because it's strange. When you actually look, verse 5, this party is for Lachol, the second line of verse 5 in the Hebrew, Lachol Ha'am Hanimtzo'im Bashushan Habira. All the people, all the nation in Shushan. And yet in verse 9, there is a separate party for the women. So are the women not invited to the first? What is going on? So this is where it's interesting to actually play the Persian context card. And so there is lots of what is called extra biblical evidence. This is historical documents that paint a why, because historians are interested in reconstructing, you know, the Persian Empire. So within Persian society, it was actually a very standard practice for parties to be one party for men, one party for women. Or to state that a different way, one party for husband, one party for wives. Now, I know what you're thinking, that's so frum. Wow. Separate part. That's like when you go to, you know, weddings and there's a giant 10-foot wall patrolled by what Rottweilers in the middle, and it's men on one side, women on the other. This, wow. So from separate gender parties. No, because it wasn't, and that was why I changed it from men and women to husbands and wives. It wasn't there were only men in the men's party. There were other women, just not the men's wives, at their parties. The concubines, the this is, the that's, Persian society very much, you know, had this within its, and this is kind of obvious because, you know, the parts of Megillat Esther we all kind of never really digest too clearly is like how the entire second parak is talking about the entire details of the king's harem, you know, so like, again, this is a very, you know, it's a very different society to societies we are more familiar with. You know, there was a tremendous amount. It's not just alcohol being served at the men's party. There's a tremendous amount of licentiousness going on at this party too. And the wives, you know, they knew that. That was part of the social contract of their society. This was a thing. A good wife went to the wives' party and knew what her husband was getting up to. And again, there's Persian things that talk about this. It's very fascinating. So Vashti is was holding her own party. Fine. And then this helps give, again, textual rigor to when Chazal point out, you know, Achashverosh wants Vashti to come, you know, Becheter Malchut, wearing a royal diadem, Laharot Amim Bahasarim et Yofya, to see her beauty, Kitovat Mar Ahif, for she was an exceptionally beautiful person. You know, the Midrashic comment that all he wants her wearing is the crown. That she knows she is not wanting to go to the men's party because she knows what's happening in the men's party. And so for Achashverosh to summon her, as verse 10 points out, K'tov Lev HaMelech B'Yayin, he's drunk. He's absolutely off his face at this point. He's absolutely gazeboed. He is unable to function normally. And now he wants to summon his wife to the party that respectful women do not attend. Wives do not attend. There is only one purpose. And this is, again, it just adds to, it amplifies. The king has a trophy wife. He wants to show her off in the most inappropriate ways possible because that gives him pride. And she refuses to because she still has a shred of dignity. And so again, Perek Aleph just starts to more and more provide a window into the king, the country, the society with which this entire story is taking place. And so much of what is happening here, Perek Aleph does the hard work. It's one of the longer of the Prakim because it's doing the hard work to already, for us as readers, to set up so much of the plot going forward. The corruption is not going to shock us anymore because we've seen it. The insanity of Achashverosh and the advice he takes from, you know, he takes, not going to shock us. All of this has already been set up in Perek Aleph, so that as the rest of the story develops, all of these themes resurface. They all, you know, it's like, you know, Chekhov's gun, don't show the gun in Act 1 unless it's going to go off by Act 3, that kind of idea. So this is, I don't know enough literary terms, movie terms, script writing terms to know anything more than Chekhov's gun. That's probably actually a much better term for what I'm trying to describe. But all of these various themes are already raised in Perek Aleph, and then they will become recurring themes throughout the rest of the Perek, explaining the various plot details going on. At this point,